As I mentioned, for all practical purposes, only the goddesses are worshipped by blood sacrifice. And among the goddesses, especially Kali, the goddess Kali, the animal is beheaded by the priest, his blood is smeared by the priest, first on himself, then on the people, on their foreheads, and then after the sacrifice of whatever animal has been killed, the people receive a small portion as remnants from the deity. You can imagine what an agnostic, comparative religionist would do with all of this. Besides the worship through the practices in the home, through the sacrifices of various kinds, through the temple ritual, believing Hindus, and I'm told that most Hindus do this. They make some kind of a vow to the god or goddess whom they favor. In other words, vow taking is very common among the Hindus. Now, this is a little unlike, we're going to see some of Muslim vow taking. Vows also may be taken by the Muslims to ask for a favor, but more often among the Muslims, he will be taken to thank God, in that case Allah, for having received a favor, or as a propitiation. But among the Hindus, the vows are generally taken to obtain something which the people want. What they do in order to obtain what they want is to join some act of mortification which they promise to perform in the event that their favor is granted. Among the promises they make, and some are very difficult, the most common are to travel a certain distance. The Ganges River is the favorite, and the Ganges can be hundreds of miles. I don't know my geography of India that well, but it can mean almost like trekking across the United States on foot and to bathe in the Ganges, or abstinence from certain kinds of food. And among the favorite things is to abstain from salt, which I'm told for a Hindu can be real mortification, and also from various kinds of spiced food, from spicing the food, which again I am told, without the spicing is almost nauseating. You simply must have it heavily spiced, otherwise it's almost inedible. Yet they will abstain for weeks or months, or in some dramatic cases, for years. Another practice among the Hindus, which carries through their whole life and profoundly affects much of their thinking, is belief, as you would expect them to believe, in the effect of the stellar body, and therefore horoscopy. They believe, of course, that the time when a person is born, the circumstances, the constellation, and so on, in the heavens, will determine that person's lot. Ritual practice, which a person is either to do or to avoid, and depending on his fidelity to that practice, he will obtain or fail to obtain the blessing. I have here from our Christian Monday through Sunday, starting in that direction. Now, I want to add immediately, I want to emphasize this. Running through this is a bewildering variety of practices. What I'm coming to, by the way, in fact, everything that I have said is practiced by all the Hindus, though not all with equal fidelity. What we're talking about now is, I'm told, so commonplace in India, they just grew up in it. Monday is a time when cloth and shoes are not to be bought, nor eastward traveling. Birth and weddings on Monday are good. While the weddings can be planned, the births are hard to plan. Monday, incidentally, I should mention this, is specially dedicated to the god Shiva. As, by the way, in olden days among the Germanic gods, Monday was specially dedicated to the god of the moon. Tuesday, its very name means auspicious. Tuesday is the luckiest day in the week. There is to be no sowing of seed, and for men, no shaving or buying, no travel northward. Fortunately, these days don't overlap, otherwise you couldn't travel. A man in whose horoscope, and the word is Mangala, falls in the seventh mansion will be unlucky in his married life. Well, that's just a point to mention. The traveling we mentioned to the north is not auspicious. Wednesday is good for the birth of a boy. It's bad for a girl. Anything done on Wednesdays will bear double fruit. It is a good day to buy cloth and to start a case in court. Thursday is not good for traveling southward. It is recommended, if a person is sending his child to a school, to start him off on Thursday. Thursday is good for eating white food, rice, and sugar especially. Friday is good for buying land. It is dedicated to the planet Venus. I should also say that Wednesday is dedicated to Mercury. Friday, therefore, dedicated to the planet Venus. It is good for buying land and bad for traveling westward. Saturday is bad for almost anything, except for moving into a new home, which happens seldom, for beginning a friendship, which is also seldom, or for engaging a new servant. It is dedicated to the planet Saturn. It is known as a slow day. If you call on a doctor on Saturday, you will not easily get rid of him. In other words, you're going to stay sick a long time. And Sunday is the day of fast, especially for lepers and barren women, the one to bear a child, the other hopefully to recover. Sunday is a great day for traveling in any direction. It is the day of the sun. In fact, studies have been made, when we speak of Indo-Germanic language, it is also accurate to speak of Indo-Germanic religion. And consequently, much of the polytheism and mythology of the Teutonic tribes, pre-Christian and even contemporary for centuries until the Teutons became Christian, is a carbon copy of India. Also along with the days of the week, the lunar days of the lunar month, and for the Hindus, the lunar month and not ours, is typical, is religious. just to mention a few without spending too much time on this. The 11th day of each fortnight is holiest and best. The 1st, 3rd, 9th, and 14th are the opposite. The last day of the month, the moonless day, is a risky day, especially for selling and buying. No sowing is to be done, and marriages never take place on the last day. Eclipses portend some kind of dissatisfaction on the part of the gods, and consequently prayers are said. The gods are invoked, especially the demon god Rahu. Now, along with the gods, the Hindus also worship a myriad of demons and evil spirits against whom the people must be protected. Amulets, therefore, are worn to ward off evil. The amulet may contain the image of a god, a small piece of paper, or a bark on which the Gayatri can be written, or some special prayer which the person wants. It is important to drive away evil spirits at the time of birth. These amulets are usually armless too. In other words, they are worn on the person. And if you know much about fetish worship, or among those who practice animism, and this, of course, the pariahs especially do a lot of this, there was a close connection, they believe, between what a person either had, whether it was part of his body, or what he wore, or what he used, and the kind of spirit that animated that person, and the way in which that person will affect somebody else. And consequently, relics, now in a Hindu sense, are in profusion all over Asia. In fact, the use of relics, now again we have to change the concept, but the use of relics as something which is left over after the person has died is most common both in Hinduism and Buddhism. And the relic is that much more effective the closer it is to the person, and therefore if it is part of that person, and even a living person, a part of his hair, a bit of his nails, or after his death, a bit of his flesh or bone. Thus, for example, as we shall see when we take up Buddha, he was, of course, cremated, and parts of his, or maybe just a jar full of his ashes, were spread all over India, and all over the Orient. And temples have been worshipped, which have been defended, and wars have started in defense of a temple where a pinch of Buddha's dust was reserved. There are also wandering spirits. These are to be propitiated by giving them a home and due homage. Now, this is pretty close to animism, but these wandering spirits may somehow either inhabit or may somehow become attached to objects that otherwise have no particular significance, like a stone or a habitation. Now, there are sects in Hinduism that worship these spirits. And their cult is to worship them. Devil worship, of course the word devil becomes something different for the Hindu, is not uncommon. And our men tell us that after you spend a couple of years in India, you really believe that there are spirits that are malevolent. And if you had to take only on faith that there are evil spirits before you went to India, you acquire empirical evidence to that effect. Incredible things are done by agents that simply cannot be explained naturally and that are malevolent, that are malicious. This, by way of a parenthesis, some years ago when I was teaching apologetics in theology, one of the things that we came upon in the New Testament was the amount of exorcism that Christ performed. As you know, there are all kinds of exorcisms, almost every page of the Gospel, especially Mark. And by contrast, there's very little of it in the Old Testament. Very few demons, in the negative sense of an evil spirit, in the Old Law. He appears in the early pages of Genesis. Saul has some trouble with him. But otherwise, the Old Testament doesn't have much demonology. You come to the Gospels, it's all over the place. And you can imagine what shrewd comparative religionists do with all that demonology. So they say, why, of course, how typical of an uncultured religion. And they believe they have something to support them by what they see in such religions as Hinduism, because these wandering spirits, especially the evil ones, who need to be propitiated, are especially favored by the lower caste or even the pariahs, the outcasts. However, what I also pointed out, now I admit, we theologize when we say this, but it is remarkable, and it is substantiated by missionaries working in such places as India, that there seems to be a profusion of what we would call diabolism, or of activity that is malicious or malevolent, and that cannot be easily explained on purely natural grounds, as Christianity comes into any particular section. And it seems that these wandering spirits, who are quite dormant and well placated, become active again. And this is one explanation that we give for the profusion of demonology in the Gospels. Because once a person believes that there are spirits who are malevolent, they would, by definition, be uncomfortable with a spirit which is opposite to them. If you can get your hands easily on a copy of the Roman ritual, that's the complete ritual, it contains, and there is an English translation available. In fact, now the new ritual has Latin on one side and English on the other. If you read there about 20 pages on exorcism, the first three or four pages describe how to recognize a genuine possession. I forget how many rules, about a dozen, say. And they're all very good to distinguish a genuine possession from some kind of pathology, from a nervous disorder, hysteria. And one of the rules is you can recognize genuine possession. The evil spirit has really somehow obsessed or possessed this person. By the way, this person, if he has been quiet and rather placid, reacts. The moment you begin to either bring a sacred object towards him or begin to invoke prayer, or above all, the moment you bring in the Blessed Sacrament, the violence, the contortion, the physical reaction to the point of beating the one who does this is one way to recognize genuine possession. One of our Jesuit fathers, incidentally, this is a big parenthesis, as you notice, one of our Jesuit fathers, Father Wilberding, in Cleveland, this was back in the late 20s, was called in to exorcise a young woman in Cleveland. She had been all kinds of doctors and psychologists had worked on her and nothing seemed to help. And yet she wasn't not pathological in the ordinary sense. So as a Catholic family, they asked the bishop, and the Bishop Schrems at the time, got our Jesuit who was teaching at the high school there, to appoint him officially as exorcist, and took him several months to succeed in exorcising the girl. And he finally succeeded by offering Mass in the home. But among, of course, this is one of the, you can imagine, classic Jesuit stories in the Midwest provinces, that one way that he immediately spotted the possession of the fact that this was a diabolical situation was the reaction against him the moment he began to use either religious language or the rituals. And among the things which he did to help the cause was to go on an almost perpetual fast, live on a starvation diet. But as a matter of fact, he died before the end of the year from nervous prostration over the thing that happened. His cause has been introduced, but as you know so typically, Americans somehow don't know how to canonize their saints. Close parenthesis.
This concludes Father Hardin's talk on the practices and beliefs of Hinduism, ritual and worship. On the next tape, Father Hardin speaks on the four sacraments of Hinduism.